Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join us. Thrilled to welcome back Helen Lewis, staff writer at The Atlantic, who is also the author of a new book, The Genius Myth, A Curious History of a Dangerous Idea. Helen Lewis, thank you so much for joining me. What possessed you to write this book?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and one that I've asked myself several times in the last couple of weeks since it's come out, because it's such a giant topic, isn't it? You know, lots of people have been writing about genius for centuries now. But I just really like the idea that this was a word that lots and lots of people were using, but maybe none of us really had any idea about what we meant by it. I think that's just kind of inherently interesting when you have words that are so heavily debated. And underneath that is a concept, again, that people can't agree on. You know, you have, people in the 18th century really have big struggles with it, trying to kind of define stuff. They're, for example, very interested in originality, which I think we now completely think that genius is about originality. But that's not its original meaning at all. So it also allowed me to get into some of the stuff that I'm really fascinated about celebrity and the history of intelligence testing. And, you know, all of this kind of stuff is also really fascinating to me.
Yeah. So what was the original meaning of the term genius?
Well, so the ancient Greeks and Romans, you had a genius, you know, it was a guiding spirit. You weren't a genius, you had one. And I think that sort of changed. It's hard to pinpoint exactly, but by the time of Samuel Johnson's dictionary, which is 1600s, then it has become the definition of a genius is a man of superior faculties. You know, that you can at that point describe someone as being a genius. And at the same time, you know, you've just come out of the Renaissance, where there has been a big kind of what we now think of as, I guess, being a cult of celebrity around artists. I was really fascinated by the discovery of this book, Giorgio Vasari's Lives of the Artists, which is essentially the single myth-making foundational text of all of European art history. And it's quite wild to be able to just to trace and kind of an entire discipline back essentially to this one guy who was, you know, he loved Michelangelo. He was a very proud Florentine patriot. You know, he deliberately wrote in Tuscan, so a kind of dialect that would have been spoken by people rather than Latin, which was the language of the elite. And he, you know, he created lots of the kind of ways that we talk about art to this day. And I just think when you find things like that, it just, you know, every art gallery I go around for the rest of my life, I will be thinking about things that I found out from Vasari. And it just deepens your appreciation of stuff, I think, to have that background knowledge.
So it seems to be, it seems to annoy you, based on my reading of the book, that people who of extraordinary ability create a cult around themselves. And that so often the people who come down to us as geniuses, or who are depicted in our own time, living people who are depicted as geniuses, are get this designation, not so much necessarily because of their inherent traits, but because they're really great at PR, or they have the good fortune to be in the right place at the right time. Is that accurate?
I think that probably is accurate. I think I'm quite sort of justice sensitive, should we say. Like it really annoys me when I feel that people are overrated or underrated. Mm-hmm. And then one of the consistent things that you find is that the same people with the same level of achievements, you know, one of them has embraced this kind of public role, becoming a brand, and one of them hasn't. And, you know, their reputations are adjusted accordingly. It is not necessarily the case that the most interesting people working in Silicon Valley are the ones we hear about all the time. It might just be that Sam Altman, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, you know, whoever else, Mark Andreessen, the other people you want to talk about are just simply eloquent spokesmen for the things that they believe in. You know, if you ask people who the greatest mathematician working today is, I bet lots of them would say Terence Tao, but that's someone that very few people outside the field have heard of, because he does give interviews, but they are, you know, technical and about the things that he's passionate about. He doesn't sort of want to kind of appear on TV in a lab coat selling you, you know, quack remedies based on his supposed genius. And I just find that concept quite interesting. And it also does make people quite defensive, I think, because, and I think this was something I really felt when I was writing the book, is that who you think is a genius is often a way for you to say something about yourself.
Mm. So what does this tell us about you?
Well, someone did ask me that, about like, who do you think your genius is? And I said, well, I really love the writer Terry Pratchett. And I think that there is a kind of narcissism in having a favorite writer. I mean, really interested to hear who your favorite writer is, because I would say that one of the reasons I've now realized that Terry Pratchett isn't one of my favorite writers. So he's a comic writer. He wrote a whole series of fantasy novels, but they're really humane. He has this attitude. And I think, as we said before, I grew up in a religious family. And I think one of the nicest things when you meet a really good priest or rabbi or imam or vicar or whoever it might be, is that they have a kind of wonderfully relaxed attitude towards humanity, right? They've seen the worst of it, but they've also seen the best of it. They've seen how we're really flawed, but also that lots of people are trying. And I really love that empathetic humanism that you get. And I also feel you get it from Terry Pratchett. So, you know, that's my kind of sort of guiding star in everything that I do and what I'm trying to write, is that yes, people can be very annoying, but also they are capable of wonderful, magical things. And we should be quite forgiving of ourselves and of other people for that reason. And so I think that's why he's my kind of hero in writing terms.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And so it brings me to
Tell me yours.
Do I have a favorite writer? Oh, yeah. No, I don't really think I do.
Did you have one when you were growing up? Maybe one that you've outgrown now.
Yes, when I was growing up, it was William F. Buckley.
I can see that, though, because he's quite swashbuckling. He's very intellectually self-confident.
Exactly.
Like, I can see that that's something you just think, wow, he goes on TV and he just argues with anybody. And he's always so composed and so eloquent. That's very impressive.
So I wrote it's funny you should say swashbuckling, because in the obituary that I wrote for him in 2008 when he passed away, I said he was, for us young conservatives, he was our Samuel Johnson and Errol Flynn wrapped up in one.
I mean, the only I don't know very much about him, not being steeped in the traditions of American conservatism, but there was a brilliant play about him on a couple of years ago, written by James Graham, who's one of our most promising playwrights, about that Gore Vidal interview
and the way that
they end up kind of baiting each other.
It was a moment for him. It was a real low in his life. He felt that he handled it very badly, which is interesting, because Gore Vidal apparently thought it was all good sport. But anyway,
well, that's what I think is really interesting about him, is the fact that he obviously cared about getting it right. You know, I think there's a kind of that model of kind of conservative swashbuckler. There are lots of them who just seem to do it for the love of the game, and they're really good at arguing, and they just love to dunk on people. But I think you always got, with a sense of him, there was a deep principle behind it.
People who met him, pretty much everyone from all sides of the spectrum who met him, were blown away by how courtly, how generous a person he was, his wonderful interest in other people, his great good manners. I mean, he was a prince of a guy in many ways. This is not to say he was perfect. He could be very too slashing and burning in his rhetoric. He defended McCarthy, which was a terrible thing in my judgment. But in any event, the thing I wanted to get to about what you said about Terry Pratchett is that so many of the things in your book are about, not so much about genius, the genius myth, the cult of the genius. It's about people behaving like jackasses.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah.
And using the excuse of I am a great artist, therefore it's okay for me to behave this way. And I think what's missing in all these cases, it's not that we need to redefine what genius is. It's not that we need to be more careful about how we allocate this title, if anybody should indeed have it. And you suggest in the book that works should be labeled genius, but not people, which I think is a great idea. But the fact is, a lot of these people that you talk about, what's missing from them is just human decency, modesty, a sense of, you know, civility to other people, respect, just those basic things.
Yeah, I think it's a real story in many cases that kind of worldly success can deform people's personalities in really unpleasant ways. You know, they often lose whatever it was that was perfect about them at the start, or their gift. And this, again, I think is why being called a genius is in some ways really harmful for people, is that it's a bit like that thing about how people get trapped at the age at which they became famous. There's mm-hmm. a sort of way in which people get trapped into this kind of crusty shell of their reputation, and it actually becomes harder and harder for them to kind of do the thing that they wanted to do in the first place. I was just thinking about the fact that Kazuo Ishiguro, great writer, won the Nobel Prize, and one of his interviews afterwards, he said a fellow writer had said to him, "You won't do any good work for 3 years. You know, you'll just be on this publicity treadmill, and you won't have the time to yourself to have those deep thoughts and reflections." And I think that's very true. If you will get to people who, you know, who get massively publicity, they can get very defensive, not least now because you get so much kind of incoming flack. But it can be really hard to preserve that space for experimentation and thoughtfulness. And also, you maybe the fire that kind of got you there in the first place gets kind of quenched by that level of success. But yeah, there is a lot of bad behavior in the book. And the fundamental question, which lots of people over time have wrestled with, and I don't think I've got a definitive answer to, is that the price you pay? Are we just going to have to say that there is collateral damage along the way? So George Orwell wrote a brilliant essay called Benefit of Clergy, in which he said about Salvador Dali that, you know, he demanded all this latitude for being an artist. And it actually genuinely did we really believe in this? And Orwell's quote, expressed in typically pungent Orwellian prose, is, "If Shakespeare came back to life today and he were found to be raping 8-year-old girls in railway carriages, should we let him continue on the basis he might write another King Lear?" And it's, you know, it's one of those things where you go, okay, wow. But that is fundamentally versions of that question is what lots of people have faced. There's another line from Steve Wozniak was about working with Steve Jobs, in which he said, "If I'd run Apple, it would have been a nicer place, but we never would have made the Mac." And so over time, people have consistently wrestled with this idea about do nice guys finish last? In fact, do you need kind of assholes in order to get things done? And I don't think anyone's really come to a final definitive answer on that one.
Back when I was growing up, there was an episode of Star Trek where Captain Kirk is somehow by an alien bisected into two people.
Right.
One, the good Kirk, and the other, the evil Kirk. And the evil Kirk is lustful and deceitful and aggressive. And the good Kirk is mild and honest and self-effacing, but of course you want the good Kirk to survive. And of course, there comes a moment where the good Kirk is at the helm of the ship. The starship is under attack, and the good Kirk finds that he cannot command because he's lacking those traits from the bad Kirk that gave him the ability to control other people and to make decisions and to be decisive and all that. So it was kind of an interesting little science fiction depiction of this.
I think that intuitively will make sense to a lot of people.
It does. Yeah.
There's a book somewhere behind me on my shelves called The Price of Greatness, which is about some of the struggles that people who've done really great work have been through. And one of the things I think probably is there's lots of very poor statistical evidence about genius, just very terrible samples. But one of the things that does reoccur and come up quite a lot, and I think is quite well evidenced at this point, is the idea that people who have that burning ambition in them and they are sort of, you know, era-defining figures often have really unpleasant childhoods. They've mm-hmm. often, for example, lost a parent young, you know, or they've been moved abroad somewhere and had to, you know, been the one kid in the class, or they've been deaf or autistic or whatever it might be, like some way in which they have just not been happy and fitted in. And that has created this kind of internal motor that has driven them to do things that maybe, as you say, maybe the nice Kirk wouldn't have done.
You know, Churchill famously said that he thought no one who had had a happy childhood could become a great man. And he did not have a happy childhood. He had a very miserable childhood in many respects. And I think he was great man. I know it's now subject of some controversy across the pond, but on the subject of do you have to pay that price? Do you have to let Shakespeare rape 8-year-olds to get King Lear? Let's talk about Churchill. Churchill had many of the flaws that a lot of the people that you cite in this book had. Selfish, you know, he could be heedless about the effects of his behavior on others sometimes, but he was not a monster. He was not raping 8-year-olds. He was not, doing even a fraction of the kinds of things that the Silicon Valley people do that Elon Musk does on a, you know, hourly basis. Right. And so on this topic of, is it necessary for greatness to be an asshole? I come down on no. I mean, there are many examples of people who've done fantastic things and managed not to allow their darker side to completely dominate.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think in lots of ways, actually, it works the other way around. And we're more likely to read someone as genius if they have the kind of biography. If someone is living a kind of very normal bourgeois life in which they're very nice to their spouse and they, you know, make a lot of time for their children, in a way, we almost count it against them. And that's the example that I give in the book of that is Paul McCartney. You know, my friend Ian Leslie wrote a really brilliant piece saying people wanted John to be the more musically interested one because he looked like what they thought a rock star should be, which was, you know, he hit his first wife. He ran off with Yoko Ono. He did all the experimental art of filming his buttocks and being in bed. And, you know, it was edgy in this kind of very subconscious way. Whereas what you got from Paul McCartney after the Beatles broke up was domesticity. You know, one of his album covers is him with the baby. He sent the kids to public schools. You know, he was just normal. And for a while, people that was in the kind of column against him as a rock star.
That was such an interesting part of your book. You know, as somebody who likes and approves of domesticity a bit, that made me angry.
Right. And I think it's really interesting when you think about it, because I don't think anyone really now, maybe some iconoclast would argue that the Beatles were a bad band, but he is just a very good example of somebody who's undeniably, incredibly musically talented and was for a long time underrated. People go, oh, you know, the Frog Chorus or Wings, and sort of imply that he'd fluked his way. And actually, as we've got further and further away from the 60s, people have been ready to talk about the fact that, for example, I mean, I'm not saying that he's this kind of like, you know, simple, honest yokel, because he was the business driving part of the band, for example. You see that very clearly in Get Back. He was phenomenally disciplined. He was a ferocious autodidact.
That was a documentary, not the song, just money.
Not the song, no, the Peter Jackson documentary. But that he, you know, I'm sure he was very difficult to be around in some of those places. He wasn't purely good Kirk, but he was also just somebody who, you know, whose children all seem to still like him. Yeah. Which is, you know, rarer than it should be among people with kind of generational musical talents. So yeah, I like that thesis as a kind of counterexample to the you have to be a bastard theory.
If you're like me, you've noticed that getting older is full of little wake-up calls. You start seeing more hair in the drain, your part looks wider, and suddenly you're zooming in on old photos wondering if your hair was always this thin. That's why I'm really loving what OneSkin is doing. Their OS01 peptide has been transforming our skin here at the Mona Charon Show for a while. Now, with their new scalp serum, OS01 Hair, it's here to help us with hair loss, thinning, and shedding. Why would a skincare company create a scalp treatment? Well, because the scalp is skin, and just like the rest of your body, it experiences cellular aging. But instead of wrinkles, it messes with your hair follicles and natural growth cycle, leading to hair loss and thinning. OS1 Hair is the first scalp serum powered by OneSkin's OS01 peptide, which targets those aging cells called senescent cells, and it's scientifically proven to help your hair cells do what they're meant to do. Grow denser, fuller, healthier hair. Get to the root of hair loss and thinning with OS01 Hair. You'll save 15% on your first purchase with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. Anybody who knows me knows that I am really, I don't, you know, obsess about personal appearance, but two things I'm really into are healthy teeth and healthy hair. So this is very important to me. Founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists, OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS01 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. Get 15% off with code MonaCharon at oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you. One of the things that you talk about is the notion that sort of genius just sort of is sprinkled like fairy dust on some people isn't true. I mean, well, it may be true, but in order for that to express itself fully and for those people to make the kinds of contributions they do, they need a support system. And I loved your chapter about the wives. So tell us about some of the famous wives in your book. Vera Nabokov, Sofia Tolstoy, is it?
Yeah, Sofia Tolstaya. Yeah, I mean, I love Vera Nabokov because I don't think that's a sad story of kind of oppression and, you know, she was vilely misused. He wrote her some completely mad but really very beautiful love letters. They were clearly, yes, you know, passionately devoted to one another. But also, there's a bit where after Lolita is published and he's getting lots of death threats, she sits there in the front row of his talks with a pistol in her handbag, you know. When he would write, you know, when he was playing the piano, she would turn the pages. They were so wrapped up in each other. And you find that so often with writers, that they're writing for somebody. There's somebody they want to impress. There's somebody in their life who is their reader. And that's what A.N. Wilson, who's the biographer of Tolstoy, said about Sofia Tolstaya, that in his early years, his really productive years, before he became a slightly odd religious and then anti-religious obsessive, his reader was Sofia, his wife. You know, he idolized her in this sort of way, which I think was quite uncomfortable for her because it required her to be this kind of pure maiden and then this sort of earth mother, but that he desperately wanted her to understand him, and he wrote the books and she copied them out, and then really the time he goes off the boil, she then falls away in his life and he becomes involved with this kind of, essentially it is genuinely a sort of cult, the Tolstoyans around him, led by Vladimir Chertkov, and the great literary works at that point just dry up. So I think that one of the things that's interesting about the wives is they often don't get the credit for the, you know, muse seems such a diminishing way to describe women. I think it's now seen as being some sort of busty actress, you know, being kind of perved over by a director, male director. But that undersells it really, in that lots of these women, you say the same about Harriet Mill and her interactions with John Stuart Mill. They were, if not co-authors, that's probably overstating it. They were a huge amount of them and their sensibility. And, you know, their kind of coexistence with the male author exists in lots of these books. The other thing I find really interesting about Sofia Tolstoya's story is the way she describes it is quite miserable. I mean, she seems to have been quite sort of highly strung. I mean, I think if I lived her life, I'd be quite highly strung too. She had 14 children.
Like 20 times or something, yeah.
Yeah, and Tolstoy had these weird crazes where everyone would have to be vegetarian or go and live in a yurt for 6 months at a time. So she describes this life of kind of misery and repression and holding back her own artistic ambitions in the service of Tolstoy's. But when she loses that, she's really miserable. And I think that's fascinating too. She fought to keep him. She fought not to let him go, you know, to the extent that he kind of left their house in the middle of the night in order essentially to die. And she initially threw herself in the pond and then got herself out and went on a railway carriage and tried to find him. And the Tolstoyans wouldn't let her in until after he was unconscious, before he died. But right until the last, she wanted to be his person. You know, she wanted to stake her claim. Even though from the outside you might have said, God, this looks like no kind of life at all. And I was really interested in that too, because the big question, you mentioned Silicon Valley. The question to me about some of those really deeply unpleasant sounding Silicon Valley companies is, why do people stick it? You know, it's a free country. There's lots of good jobs out there.
Let's go back to Tolstaya for a minute, because you said something I want to dig a little deeper on. There are many, people are so complicated, and there are many ways that people find meaning and purpose in life. And I think there is a tendency among maybe shallower types to think that the only kind of life that's worth having or fighting for is one where you're the star. Mm. And especially in our time where everybody's has to be a brand. And the idea that a woman, and it's usually a woman, but it isn't always, there are some men who've devoted themselves to their wives' careers and supporting them. But sometimes people choose to devote themselves to a spouse, and this gives them great happiness. You know, I think Itzhak Perlman met his wife at a summer music camp when they were teenagers, and she fell in love with him. And she also thought, okay, we're both violinists, but he's a genius. And I really want to help him be everything he can be. And she gave up her career. Now, you're a feminist. A lot of feminists look at that and they think that's terrible. I don't. I mean, I think, you know, if that's what made her happy and him happy, I'm not sure it's terrible. People do all kinds of things and make their own decisions. What do you think about that?
I don't think it is terrible. I think you have to not assume that people are victims of false consciousness and that their own description of their own wants and what makes them happy is true. There are many versions of that story that aren't so happy. I think Alma Mahler is the one that springs to mind, where she really fancied herself as a composer and was then forbidden after marriage from composing at all. But yeah, I also think it's hard for me to intuitively understand, because that would drive me spare. You know, one of the reasons I used to be an editor, and one of the reasons I became a writer was I was kind of like, no, me, I want to be in the spotlight now. But there's a line that John le Carré, David Cornwell in real life, his sons describe his relationship with his wife Jane, who he was serially unfaithful to, but not on the page. She was his only editor. You know, they said he burned and she fanned. And there's this description they gave of her, which really stuck with me, which is that she was so self-effacing that she would even slip out of family photos. And that's funny to me, because that's a bit like what my mum is like. My mum doesn't want to do public speaking, doesn't like any credit. Whereas my dad is like me. He's a deacon, so he loves giving up and giving speeches. And you do just have to deal with the fact that people just do have different personalities and different things. Not everybody, like you say, not everybody actually does want to be the star or finds it fulfilling or conversely has that missing bit in them that they can only fill with attention from a crowd rather than from one other person. So I don't have any problem. I think structurally there is a larger thing, which is I think it's hard for women to find men. It's harder to find your great wife in a husband.
That is true.
And I think that's for a lot of reasons. Maybe women aren't so attractive to men that they see taking a secondary slot because it's so countercultural. Maybe men don't want to do it because they find it emasculating. Maybe, you know, actually this financial incentives don't really work out that way, particularly if women take time off for childbearing. You know, they know their careers are going to be interrupted. So it makes sense to kind of put all their bets on the man's career. So, mm-hmm. You know, when I've written about feminism, I've always tried to really distinguish between individual choices, which are capricious and, you know, you just have to accept that other people do things that you wouldn't do, versus big structural forces. And I think you're right. Like the way you formulated it was exactly right, which is that there are, through history, far more great wives. Far more women have been willing to do this. And some percentage of them have been happy about it and some percentage of them have been unhappy about it. And that's, sure. that's the fairest way, I think.
And clearly, like with Alma Mahler, I mean, the idea that a husband would forbid his wife to do anything in her career is oppression. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of this is also just cultural, and it depends what time period you're talking about. I mean, that was the 19th century. It's the early 20th. And it's gotten a lot harder, I think, in our time, at least. Well, I think would you agree with that? That it's gotten a lot harder for men to make those kinds of demands and expect to find women who are willing.
Well, the thing that's really difficult now for people to manage is the fact that what's called assortative mating, you know, people in very high demanding careers tend to marry other people in very high demanding careers. We don't have so many of the boss marries his secretary marriages anymore, right? The boss marries the boss at another company.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, it's been a consistent problem for ambassadors, actually, and the British Foreign Office has found this, which is how do you find someone who's willing to be married to an ambassador?
Yeah.
And is willing to move somewhere every 3 years.
Yeah.
That's just harder now. The idea of having a sort of stay-at-home partner is very few of those people kind of are in that, you know, are getting married to people in that category.
So let's talk a little bit about Lewis Terman and his attempt to find the children who were going to be geniuses when they grew up. You devote some attention to this in the book, so why don't you tell us about it?
I think Lewis Terman was a genuinely great social scientist. He was misguided and naive, but I think in the way that any of us would have been at the time. You know, when you're working at the frontiers of knowledge, you just have to take some punts. So he starts in the 20s and 30s this longitudinal study. It's going to track a load of children in California over years. It ends up being over decades in the end. he initially calls it genetic studies of genius. And several years in, he has to concede he hasn't found any geniuses. He hasn't found a Shakespeare or a Tolstoy. And then just goes, they must just be much rarer than I had expected. And it's renamed Genetic Studies of the Gifted. But he finds out all this really interesting stuff, like the fact that higher IQ is correlated with actually with good health, which was a counterpoint to the romantic idea of genius, which was that it made you very sort of fey and wasted. You know, these kids are more, the more intelligent kids are more robust, which has been mm-hmm. supported by all kinds of research since.
Yep.
You know, and that study is
filled
with biases.
They're also better athletes than average. Higher IQ kids also have better athletic ability, which is another counterintuitive thing.
Right. You know, just
the
really
image was.
Yeah,
the smart
yeah, yeah, nerds or jocks.
And, yeah.
Right. But they now, one of the working hypotheses of like what IQ might be is it might just indicate genetic fitness. It might just indicate that everything in your body is in your development has just gone right in whatever way. So that's not necessarily now such a bizarre finding. But you're right. At the time, completely, it was, you know, pebble glasses versus the bronzed Adonis on the football field. But, you know, and his sort of his study is inevitably riddled with biases. Like reading the way that they talk about the girls in the study is quite sad. They're sort of mystified by why the girls seem to regress. And in lots of cases, that does seem to be just because their parents didn't invest in as much in their education, you know, or care about it as much, or, you know, that the expectations were put on them. But what he does, apart from anything else, is he just generates this incredible portrait of American life or Californian life in the mid-century. Some of these kids go on to incredibly interesting things. A lot of them, well, I think nearly half a dozen of them end up at Los Alamos working on the bomb. One of them dies there. One of them testifies in the Nuremberg trials. He's one of them is Jess Oppenheimer, who's one of the creators of I Love Lucy, the great sitcom. He finds lots of people with really, there's funny, but he, one thing he does reveal is it's very hard to kind of pick winners early. So one of the comments they make about Jess Oppenheimer is that he's not funny. Like, this kid has no sense of humor, and he goes on to create one of the greatest American comedies of the 20th century. So I think that, you know, it was really incredibly useful data. He just, you know, he did things like counted how many teeth they got, you know, just reams of data that researchers mm-hmm. are still finding really fascinating. But what he didn't do and what he couldn't do was find geniuses. And for me, one of the mad moments of working on this book was then finding out that William Shockley, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, from another chapter, who I'd wanted to write anyway, because I thought he had a fascinating story of someone who became obsessed in later life when his career hit the skids with IQ. Mm-hmm. It was this great revelation to find out that he was tested by Terman and he didn't make the grade. He didn't become a termite. And you think, oh, and it's one of those things where you don't want to overread it, but you go, oh, I suddenly understand why mid-career things went a bit wrong. You suddenly became obsessed with sort of writing this wrong. And he told Playboy in 1980, he said, I think my IQ's probably gone up since then. Ugh, and you think, God. No, that's not, I mean, that's literally not how it works. No one at 70 is just put on 10 IQ points. What are you talking about?
Right. And also the this deep sense of insecurity and the sense that this number, you have a section in the book where you talk about, you know, the feeling that some people have that this number will define who you are and your worth.
Yeah, I think it's really dangerous, but I also see why it happens. And the IQ societies have ended up with a kind of sad reputation, really, as a repository for people who are kind of psychologically wounded a bit by not understanding why their high IQ hasn't translated into kind of worldly success. I mean, I'm talking about the ultra high IQ societies, you know, people who are way smarter than either of us and yet have really struggled always to make it in their careers. And that's the problem with this kind of seductive power of IQ, is that it promises that there is a number of your worth that floats above your head, but there are all kinds of other things that contribute to your success in life. You know, the advantages of growing up in a stable home, not having drink or drug dependencies, you know, being emotionally intelligent, whatever that kind of means, but I think we all know it when we see it, you know, being able to get along with people. These are all very important things too.
I do believe in the idea of people being geniuses or particularly gifted. I do believe that that's the case. Acknowledging, of course, that there's a lot of mischief that goes on with people claiming to be geniuses or, you know, using as an excuse for bad behavior, which is not acceptable. But I think about somebody like Mozart, who his father, Leopold, they said, what, you know, what did you do to create this genius boy? And he said, he's a bird of paradise, which I think that's right. And it just intuitively feel although there's plenty of evidence. I mean, you know, that the unbelievable early flowering. I will confess to something. I am a sucker for videos of child prodigy musicians. I mean, I don't indulge in this very often, but every now and then I will pull up some videos of little children performing on the piano or the cello or something. Not usually the cello because it's too big for them, but
they're sweet, like a 6-year-old with a bow. I can understand why, because one of the things that lots of people have picked up about the idea of genius is there is something transcendental about it. There is something actually kind of, I mean, you know, the way that they called Michelangelo Il Divino, you know, sort of the divine. And I think there is something when you see that level of talent in a kid, because it can't have been taught,
right?
You know, it can have been shaped to practice, then there is something kind of amazing that you just go, oh, that's a type of humor that exists, that they can be playing, you know, Bach at 6. That's exactly. Amazing. And I think it is genuinely like there's that, the distinction that the Romantics made between the beautiful and the sublime, which was that, you know, some things could just be beautiful and pleasant to look at, and then some things have this extra quality of being sort of slightly frightening or awe-inspiring. And I think there's something of that in the child prodigies, where it's almost alien to some extent. It's so out of the boundaries of what you kind of normal human experience. I think that about musical ability and maybe mathematical ability too, not least because I'm such a dunce on both subjects, that you just think, well, how does a brain do that?
Me too. But it's also, isn't it the case? I think you probably came across this that, and I think actually you wrote about it in the book, that that mathematical and musical ability or giftedness tends to show up very early in life, and other kinds of gifts can take longer to mature. But if you're going to be a math genius, you probably already are showing signs of it when you're 5 or 8 or 10.
Yeah, no, we've called it right by becoming writers, because that's one of the ones that actually, as your intelligence, you know, as you shift from having that fluid intelligence to having more knowledge, you can continue writing. You know, Edna O'Brien was writing at the top of her powers until she died in her late 80s. Whereas realistically, yeah, as mathematicians, in terms of winning prizes and their best work, it tends to be in their 20s and early 30s at a push.
Well, musicians have it great because they can show up at a very early age as talented and then still have long, long careers. Pablo Casals, the cellist, was still practicing like 3 hours a day when he was 99 or something. I remember he was quite 99, but very, very old. And someone said to him, you know, at this point, why are you still practicing 3 hours a day? And you know, world famous cellist and aged. And he said, I believe I see progress.
Oh, I love that. But I also love that, again, that speaks a bit to the difference between the child prodigies who go on to do something and the ones who don't, which is often about whether or not they end up loving the thing that they're doing. Is it part of you? You know, are you most yourself when you're playing the cello? And that's something that you need. I mean, I don't know if this is how you feel about it, but certainly how I feel about writing. If you stopped me, if you forbade me from writing, I would feel like you'd kind of cut off my arm.
Yeah.
So this isn't.
I'm not sure. I still feel that way. By the way.
Oh, really? Okay.
A lot longer than you.
Okay, but you know what I mean. But it's so much about how I process the world and how I came to the world.
Yes.
In the habit of thought that I don't do it purely for money, and I don't do it purely for noble reasons of, you know, making the world a better place. I do it because I need to in some kind of slightly profound way. And I think that's the difference: is that if you're a musically talented kid and you have 2 hours of practice a day, there's a big difference, probably 2 equally talented ones, one who loves it and one who finds it an absolute chore and has killed it and is just grinding it out. Those, you know, that is something you have to kind of watch out for too, is whether or not you choke off a child's love of doing something, or whether they could happily do it for hours and hours and it will never feel like work.
You mentioned, I think in passing in the book, the 10,000 hours canard. Mm. And I remember discussing this with my friend Jay Nordlinger, who's a music critic, and we were talking about the phenomenon that is well known to musicians, which is there really are people who are just so gifted that they don't have to practice that much. You know, it just comes to them. And it's a reality that is part of life. And if you're one of the lucky ones, you are. And if not, you just have to make your peace with it, because it's true.
Well, that's I think there's something really beautiful. You must be familiar with the play Amadeus by Peter Schaeffer that they turned into a really great film. I think that's one of the most useful depictions of what the kind of category of genius does for us. Because we're all Salieri, aren't we? We're all just plodding away, trying to do our best. And then every so often, as you say, the bird of paradise comes along. And envy would be the natural, jealousy would be the natural responses to that. And I think, you know, one of my friends said to me when I was writing this, you must write about envy and jealousy, because I think just the idea of some people as a special category is a way of coping with that, really. And particularly if you believe that that category also carries with it some costs or burdens, which is how we tend to think about it. And in Amadeus, it's very much that he's just this kind of overgrown toddler who just laughs at fart jokes and has no, you know, he's just a big 3-year-old basically. Right. And then he sits down at the piano and it's divine.
Right.
And that's the way to kind of, for the rest of us who are just grinding out Salieri's very sort of generic Baroque music, that's the way that we kind of cope with it by saying, well, look, this is just a different species. I can't compete with this.
So there is that reaction. There's the envious reaction, which is normal. And I won't deny that everybody feels it to some degree, but it's not the only reaction. And I think there's a danger in letting it dominate our attitude toward people who are really gifted, because there's a deep pleasure in also just appreciating the special people.
You know, I was watching when Brian Wilson died, I saw a really great clip of him with George Martin, who was the Beatles producer. He'd made a documentary about producing music. And I think, you know, George Martin acclaimed as one of the great arrangers and producers of music. And he did an arrangement of God Only Knows, and he put a few knobs up and he put that one down. And Brian Wilson was just genuinely delighted by it. And I thought, that's, to me, is the mark of a true musician, which is, I want this music to attain its final perfect form. Anyone who can help me. In a way that this is what I mean about kind of talking about works of genius. If you're not precious about it having to be you that did it, if you just want God Only Knows to attain its, you know, most perfect form, and then what a gift that is to you, because you can, and he turns to George Martin, he says, that's better than the way I arranged it. And it's a really lovely moment of two people who are absolutely at the top of their craft, respecting each other enough to do it. And I think that's lovely when you see people who can do that. I love watching musicians from very different musical traditions jamming together. We just had Glastonbury, and Olivia Rodrigo, you know, very poppy music. She brought on Robert Smith of The Cure, aged goth from a guitar band of the 90s. And he just, you know, he's anti-showbiz completely. And she's, you know, there in her perfect PVC outfit. But there was just a level of respect on both sides, that you're both really great songwriters. And it was cross-generational. And it was really lovely to see. And then I think that, again, that to me is the better model, that you're giving the world something rather than it all be about, hey, here's me up on my pedestal, and anyone who challenges me, I need to kind of fight them off.
Yeah. Maybe one of the great takeaways from all of this examination of how we treat genius is anybody who demands that they have to have 15 children and name them after letters. anybody who says that it's the vegan diet or some other peculiarity that makes them a genius, those people probably we need to give quite a bit of side eye too.
I think that's the thing is you can, and also I think that Elon Musk, who I believe you're alluding to there, I think he's a real demonstration of somebody who has fallen for his own genius myth, and it hasn't made him happy. He could be beloved for a couple of things, you know, and instead he waded into areas that he didn't know anything about with zero humility. Has, I think, caused a huge amount of damage in destroying the PEPFAR program about AIDS in Africa, malaria projects. And now sort of I saw him tweeting saying, you know, when he went with the chainsaw on stage, I shouldn't have done that. It lacked empathy. And I think, well, yeah, if only.
No kidding.
But who in your life do you now listen to enough? You don't listen to anybody clearly in your life to ever tell you no. Mm-hmm. And you know, you don't think you, that means you don't trust anyone. You don't think there's anyone who might know more than you do. You don't think there's anyone who's got your best interests at heart who might disagree with you. You must be so lonely at the very top of this giant pillar that you've constructed for yourself and climbed up to. And I think that is, you know, it's very hard to feel sorry for him because of the sheer amount of damage he's done to people with far less money than he has. But I don't know about you, but I wouldn't trade places with him despite all his wealth. I'm happier in my very humdrum life than he appears to be in his extraordinary life.
Oh, absolutely. No, he actually screams emotional instability and neediness and weirdness. Yeah. And it's and if he had not done so much damage to so many people, one might have some sympathy. But what he did to USAID alone is it outweighs anything good he might have ever done with Tesla and the rest of it.
I'm pleased that I've convinced you. I thought you were going to be a bit more skeptical about my book, because one of the things that I do say, you can see my inherent leftism coming out a bit in this book, Mona, which is that I'm more attracted to social forces as explanations. I'm quite wary of that kind of great man theory. So if I've won you over, then I can consider that to be a great triumph.
Since you mentioned great man theory, that is an area where you and I differ. But I hate the title. I wouldn't call it great man. And it's not just because it excludes women. It's not that. It's that it's not greatness. It's consequentialness, if you will.
Yeah.
I do think individuals are unbelievably consequential. And so that, there was a huge argument happened many decades ago, but it was, would there have been a Holocaust without Hitler, that kind of thing. And I very firmly believe that individuals matter for good and ill. And that, in our own time, people say, well, Donald Trump, is a product of our time, of Twitter, of all of these things. And I agree, he is. All of those things contributed to it. But if it were someone other than Donald Trump, it wouldn't be what we're experiencing now. The cult around him is something unique to him. And the damage he's doing to the country, I think, would not be done by someone else. So I do believe very strongly that individuals matter. Tell me if you disagree with that.
I would definitely say in politics, I think that is right. I do think that clearly anti-Semitism has a long history. It might not have taken that particularly potently appalling form if it hadn't been for somebody with the organizational capacity and charisma of an Adolf Hitler. I think you could say the same thing about, I went to Trump rallies last year where I watched a series of people doing the warm-up act, doing what were essentially poor impressions of Trump. There are lots of people who have tried to do Trumpian things and they lack the crazy mixture of the funniness, the campness, the great comic timing, the sort of weird digressions, the kind of complete shamelessness, then the snap into bullying. Like just the whole package is extraordinary and kind of internally contradictory. And it's amazing that it works. I think it's a bit harder when you come to things like inventions, because actually the evidence that we have is that certain things are kind of their time has come. And maybe somebody gets there 10, 5, whatever, 50 years earlier than it would have been. But I think lots of them do have that inevitable way to them. And then when it comes to arts and literature, I think that there are so many great writers who are not acclaimed and seen as geniuses, that one is much more a cultural label. I mean, where I guess you might push back on that is that someone like Shakespeare is genuinely extraordinary. And had there not been a Shakespeare, had there just been a few more John Nash's, Ben Jonson's, we wouldn't have English drama in the way that it is today. Like, he is undoubtedly head and shoulders above his peers and consequential. But in lots of cases, I think people are a bit more replaceable. But I think you're right. I think politics is the one area that is different, because it's about people making those kind of world-changing decisions. I mean,
business. I mean, I remember when I was a teenager and my parents took me to New York City and we were looking at the skyscrapers, and it suddenly dawned on me that the names on so many of these enormous buildings were of people, of individuals who, for whatever reason, had been able to build these things and put their names on them. This was pre-Trump, and that's a whole other story.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been to Chicago, and I turned around a corner, and I was just like, whoa, okay, that's a big name on the building, right? We're really not holding back on that one.
Yeah, but individuals are incredibly important in business and in education, so many areas. And for good or ill, again, there's a woman, this is a pet peeve of mine, there is a gal whose name I'm going to forget right now, who was associated with Teachers College at Columbia University for many years. And she put out the idea about whole language learning, that students should learn to read not by phonics, but by sort of guessing and figuring out. Anyway,
Lucy Calkins, you're talking about,
yes,
aren't you? I wrote a piece about her. I think she got slightly hit with a... I don't think she was... I've got strong thoughts about her in the back. But so, I think you're
so
right. You can say definitely whole
rebutted.
Language. Yeah,
she's been rebutted a million times. And lately she's actually had to... She's been sued and she's had to, I think, do a big pullback from her positions. But this one person... was able to influence the teaching of reading for generations in this country and harming generations of students, making them less good readers. So again, an individual who had a huge impact. But so before leaving the topic entirely, I would just say that what I would take away from your book is that yes, there are moments where an invention is kind of pregnant in the air and somebody is going to come up with it. That's not always the case. And it might have taken who knows how many more years longer before somebody did. One of the people that you do talk about somewhat critically in the book, and that's fair, is Albert Einstein. But he did behave badly, but one of his quotations that's very apt for our discussion is he supposedly said, "If I have been able to see further than other men, it is because I stood on the shoulders of giants." So that's the right attitude, right?
That's the right. Yeah. That, funnily enough, that quotation also gets attributed to Isaac Newton, who also spent a large part of his, I mean, he spent a large part of his career desperately trying to take down Gottfried Leibniz and getting the credit for calculus.
Calculus.
So,
yes.
But I do think it is a good way of thinking about it. Like, I always try and think about being that metaphor of the beehive. You know, there's lots of bees that have the potential to be a queen. And it's kind of about who gets fed the royal jelly. And that's something that we should always be really attentive
that's
to.
True.
Just because, and you look through American history and you see the number of groups. I was quite shocked. I had no idea about the fact that the Jewish people were excluded from the Ivy League until the 20s and 30s, you know, because it was just feeling that, gosh, there's awfully too many of them. And these universities aren't very WASPy anymore. And we don't like that. And so they took a group that by all metrics was performing extremely well academically and ruthlessly found ways to exclude them. And you just see things like that so many times.
And then they did the same thing with Asian students.
And Asian Americans now, and under affirmative action, yeah. That you just see these situations in which people don't act in this very merit-based way, you know, whilst maintaining that these are kind of natural and immutable standards. It's very telling, I think.
It is. All right. Well, let us spend just a few minutes, because you wrote a great piece that came out this week in The Atlantic about people's bubbles where they yeah. are sort of insulated from facts. And you were writing about the Scrimeti decision. So tell us about that, especially, you know, one of the biggest talking points for activists on and I think both you and I believe that adults should be given all respect and should be, you know, addressed by the names they prefer and the pronouns they prefer. And never, you know, there should be no discrimination against people on the basis of being trans and so forth. But the argument that the culture is having, that we're all having, is okay, but how much are we going to, when it comes to treating children with gender dysphoria, how much are we going to be guided by activists and how much are we going to be guided by the scientific evidence?
Yeah, so, it's really telling when you listen to American activists talk about the subject. They'll say, look, this is backed by all American medical associations. You know, there is a consensus on this.
Yeah.
And that's a very deliberate choice of wording, because there is a consensus, but it's not one that's backed by the evidence. So they can't really straight-facedly say all the evidence supports medical transition. So puberty blockers, hormones, and very rarely surgery for under 18s. And, you know, the Scametti decision was really interesting for a couple of different reasons. So Tennessee had banned blockers and hormones for under 18s. And what the activists thought their one way of getting it knocked down was to say that it needed extra scrutiny because it potentially relied on, you know, sex classification. So their argument was that you can give children who don't have gender dysphoria, who have precocious puberty, these hormone blockers. But if you can't give them to quote-unquote transgender children, then that's discrimination on the basis of sex. The court didn't have any of this. The 6-3 conservative majority said these are just two different diagnoses. And that, to me, unfortunately, made complete sense, because in precocious puberty, you take the blockers until the rest of your classmates all start puberty, which you come off them. There are no long-term effects that we know of. You go through your normal natal puberty, you are fertile, you'll be able to have a sex life. If you're the gender non-conforming kid and you take blockers, almost all of those kids end up going on cross-sex hormones. That has potential implications for their fertility, for their sexual function, and maybe even other consequences we don't really know about yet. Like, there may be some effect on brain development or bone density. So
bone
just
density, there's lots
two
of evidence.
Very, very different medical cases there. Yeah. And unfortunately for the activists, I mean, this was argued by the Biden administration and the ACLU, the conservative justices just seemed incredibly well-read on the subject and asked some really perceptive questions. One of which was, I believe, Clarence Thomas asked during the oral questioning of Chase Stranger of the ACLU, is it fair to describe these treatments as life-saving, as you often do, and everybody within this movement often does? Is there any evidence they reduce suicide? And Stranger said no, because, you know, suicide is a very rare event and the studies aren't big enough. Now, as it happens, two things from that. One, there is actually a Finnish study that has thousands of kids enrolled in it. It's a very, like, a cohort study. And that, again, didn't find that the blockers and hormones reduced actual completed suicides. There is some research that suggests it might reduce suicidal thoughts, but even that's contested. And the other thing is, okay, so you say it's a very rare event and you can't see it in the data. Why have you been saying that to parents, as Joanna Olsen Kennedy did, do you want a, you know, dead son or a living daughter? That's the choice. And that was something that throughout the 2010s, I heard all the time as I was covering this story, that parents were being told, look, this is very simple. You have to accept your kid, and not just accept your kid, but put them on this medical pathway now, because the alternative could be their death. And of course, that's an incredibly blunt force to use on any parent. You know, what parent wouldn't instantly be incredibly panicked by that prospect, particularly if their child is already really unhappy?
Yeah.
But there is not good evidence for it. There is an absence of evidence for it, in fact, I think you can say at this point. And so I wanted to write about it because I think Andrew Sullivan described it basically as the kind of left's version of January the 6th, which is that there are just people who just do not know these facts. They are entirely live within a media universe in which these things have just simply never got through to them, because what they're hearing from all the charities and from the groups is just that nope, there's no problems with these treatments. The only people who hate it are, you know, evil transphobic Republicans who just want your children to be unhappy and maybe die. And that's one of the reasons for me, it's like why you would write this piece in The Atlantic, which I think is read by, for a start, a lot of people, 1.1 million subscribers, but also a pretty broad cross-section of the middle of America.
Yep.
And I think probably will have reached some people who hadn't heard that there is no evidence for that claim before.
So unfortunately, the existence of MAGA world and the cruel and heedless Republicans who argue on this topic make it so much harder for people like us who genuinely are concerned about the kids here and don't want to see children who are too young to make these kinds of decisions railroaded into making a lifelong choice. I concede there may be some children for whom this is good treatment. I don't know. I'm waiting for the evidence, because that there needs to be a lot more study of it. But I'm willing to say that might be true. But
yeah, the early Dutch study, which found better results, was on a very different population to the one that we're effectively seeing today, and which I think is something that has changed how I feel about it.
Yep.
You know, maybe there is a group of kids who gender dysphoria is their primary problem. They felt it very early in childhood. They're primarily biologically male. Maybe that is a discrete cohort.
And they've been carefully studied to make sure that there aren't other things, that they're not autistic, that they're not, you know, confused, that they're not just gay and unhappy about that, or many other, or they haven't been abused. I mean, there are so many other comorbidities that show up in the population of kids who present at first as having gender dysphoria. So any reasonable clinician would want to make sure that they've evaluated, because the consequences of this treatment are dire. You know, I mean, now for some people it may be great, but for everybody it means they're going to be infertile, and you can't make a decision like that in childhood and have a real understanding of what you're giving up. Many will never have an orgasm. And some portion, you know, we don't know what the long-term consequences are of being on these cross-sex hormones for decades. We don't know. And, you know, there's fear that, for example, being on, if you're born natal male and you're on estrogen for all those years, you may be more at risk for heart disease. There's some evidence that, again, you know, these are all just threats that are out there possible. In any event, the you know, for a kid to make that kind of a lifelong decision, you would hope that it was carefully entered into. And as those of us who followed this issue over the years have noted, there are lots of clinics, because they're under pressure from the activists, and also because they've gotten no pushback from the professional medical organizations who've just fallen in line for, I think, because it's fashionable. But kids are getting prescribed hormones after one visit, And that is just irresponsible. And there needs to be a slowdown, and let's be careful about this, including some advocates for trans kids with trans with gender dysphoria, who have said, you know, for their benefit too, for everybody's benefit, we need to be a lot less rigid and categorical about these things, and saying things like, my 7-year-old knows, so therefore, you know, we have to start, you know, treating them as the opposite sex and medicating them. I mean, it's just, I think this is comparable to lobotomies or other kinds of medical interventions that were done.
Yeah, or recovered memory syndrome in the 1990s, yes, which was an extremely fashionable diagnosis. And I would say there was no doubt in that case that many of the people involved with that did have really serious troubles and trauma. It just wasn't the one that the therapists were imputing onto them. And I think you're right. That's what some of the things that we see here is, these kids are genuinely really distressed.
Yes.
And they obviously do need support and therapy. They certainly don't need to just be told to get over it. But the question is, right, is really about medicalization. You're right. The thing that I hadn't, that I saw through this, and both, there's also some cases, there's a case that went in Alabama that the, I think the ACLU decided not to pursue that one to the Supreme Court. They thought the Tennessee one was better. But there are documents that were unsealed in the Alabama case, which show WPATH, which is the World Professional Organization for Transgender Health that makes the guidelines. Doctors, they're discussing among themselves exactly what you're saying, that some people involved in this treatment are essentially cowboys, who just have no gatekeeping tool, providing what they call sloppy care, you know. And then the discussion then moves to, but if we say we're worried about the evidence base, which we are, because we think it's quite thin, that will be used by Republicans. And I think it's a sad story, as you say, of people on the left who think that any questions about the treatment are inherently transphobic and must only be raised by people who don't want trans people to exist. And then on the other side, unfortunately, the bans have entrenched them in that position, and it has become a kind of, you know, just a sort of, you know, you plant your flag is about whether or not you're progressive or not. To be pro-trans is to be pro-medicalization of minors. And that's, you know, that's very unfortunate, I think.
Agreed. And, you know, it's funny because the people in Europe to whom American liberals, progressives tend to look to for guidance about good policy, people in, you know, in Sweden and Finland and France and Great Britain and other countries,
they dismiss Britain, and therefore they dismiss me as being part of Turf Island. You know, there is a feeling that, you know, everybody here is just, you know, desperate.
Okay.
So maybe not conservative. But you're right. I don't think you can dismiss Sweden or Finland in the same way. You know, these notoriously socially conscious Scandinavian countries with great paternity leave, and you know they are not Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee.
Exactly.
They are fundamentally liberal countries that have nonetheless looked at the evidence base.
Exactly. That's really what it is. Is trying to look at the evidence. And again, you know, it's everything that the left thinks about the right on this issue is true, except for one thing. I mean, they are badly motivated. They are cruel. They are, you know, all of those things are true, except in this instance, it is right.
They're also right about the evidence base, which is thin. Yeah. I know. I've written this in copy before. I'd be like, I know that Ted Cruz is wrong about most things. Unfortunately, this isn't one of them. Like occasionally he might, a stop clock is right twice a day, guys.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But tell me, do you think it's getting, from your perspective, where you write, do you think it's getting less heated? I wonder actually if the Democrats are slowly conceding on lots of these issues. They know they're really unpopular and they are not, you know, they're making tokenistic representations against some of this stuff, but they're really quite happy to let it happen and let the issue be settled and won't really pick it back up again. I'm thinking about the same thing about women's sports. You know, I think they're quite, in some ways, I wonder if there's a little bit of some of the centrist Democrats that thinks, well, these bans will come in and then we will just simply never mention this issue again.
So maybe, but here's my worry, is that there may be some people, some progressives who will say, look, this just isn't selling. And so we have to soft pedal it for a while, but they are not convinced. They still believe that the right position is the, you know, medicalization of youth position. And so, you know, maybe they'll soft pedal it for a little while, but their minds have not been changed. And maybe even they'll be resentful of having to, you know, swallow their doubts. And therefore, it will roar back at some later point. I would like to see them, you know, open their minds to some of the things that they might not have considered and maybe even think that, you know, they're on the that they're not in the right on this issue. But I don't know.
I know what you mean. I would rather have the discussion and say, here's the evidence and people look at it and change their minds on that basis and win it that way, which I think is essentially what happened with gay marriage. You know, people said, well, this doesn't really affect you. You can still have your own straight marriage. And then it happened and people were like, oh yeah, okay, no, this seems real. And you know, I know that support for that has slid slightly, but it's just not an issue in the way that it was when I was young at all. But you're right. And I think the other thing that's really having my UK perspective, where Labour, our centre-left governing party, has essentially conceded all of this stuff to be true. And even some of the more sensible charities have backed away from it. The elite signals are really important. The thing that would make most difference is if there was a new head of the ACLU who said, yeah, we're not doing this anymore. This isn't a free speech issue. This isn't core to what we're doing. We want, you know, if you get people who are being sacked for being transgender, fired for being transgender, that's absolutely in our wheelhouse. We'll do it. But we're not in the business of interfering in medical decisions that we don't fully understand at this point.
Right.
But yeah, so that's fingers crossed. All the American medical associations could actually, you know, get off the fence and say, here are the thing, here are the conversations we're having in private. Let's also have them in public.
Yes, but exactly.
I don't feel a great deal of optimism about that happening.
No, nor do I. But we will keep trying to tell the truth as best we know how.
Yeah.
So Helen Lewis, thank you so much for joining me. It's been great to talk with you, and I enjoyed your book, recommended to people, The Genius Myth.
You've got the dodo. I love the dodo cover. Thanks so much, Mona, for the conversation. I always like, it's very nice to talk to somebody who I think is, you know, super smart and I respect, but doesn't agree with me about everything. You've got to get out of your bubble, right?
You do. 100%. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye.